Welcome to the Texas Water Symposium. The title for this symposium is The Texas Hill Country and Change, People, Property, Planning, and Springs. The symposium is a joint project between Shriner University, Texas Tech University, Texas Public Radio, and the Hill Country Alliance. When we started this Texas Water Symposium last year, we got to talking in a group session and talking about the issues in the Hill Country and surrounding regions, and for that matter, the state of Texas. And one of the most prevailing issues that we were concerned about and we thought the public should be informed about was water. And when we developed themes for the Water Symposium, one of the things we recognized was that population growth is going to be a critical issue in the upcoming century, in the next few decades. And we also recognized that water, as essential as it is a complex issue. And oftentimes when we hear about water, and reading in newspapers or other sources of information, it's a single topic issue. But it's a complex issue, and problems associated with water are going to require complex solutions. So the purpose of the Water Symposium is to provide information so that we can have an informed public, so that that informed public can make informed decisions about our natural resources, in particular water, in the upcoming decades. Associated with recognizing what are the complexities associated with water, whether it's distribution and abundance, groundwater versus surface water, urban versus rural, economic issues, ethical issues, biological issues, and so forth, we also wanted to address where there's problems, there's also solutions. And we also wanted to inform the public that where these solutions typically come from are on the basis of science, conservation and education, or policy and law. The variety of topics that we've had with the Texas Water Symposium all deal with the complexity, solutions, and ways that we can address the issues with water in the upcoming century. For this panel, we have Robert Potts as moderator, and I'll give you a brief rundown on Robert Potts in terms of his background, and I'll let Robert introduce the panelists for tonight's symposium. Robert Potts is presently president of the Dixon Water Foundation, a private foundation supporting sustainable watershed management. Prior to that, he was general manager of the Edwards Aquifer Authority, and prior to that, he was the state director of the Nature Conservancy of Texas. Robert brings to us a wealth and breadth of issues and experience to help us understand some of these issues and interact with the panelists for tonight's programs. And I'm going to turn it over to Robert. Thank you all for coming. Robert?
Thank you, Tom. We're going to dive right into this and go into our first presentation. And the first presenter is Sean Gerritsen. He is the president of Pegasus Planning, which is an award-winning development consulting firm. He's been helping the Hill Country Alliance with their 2030 study of projected population increase. He's going to be assisted in his presentation by B.B. and Mary Fenstermaker. They own the Maverick Ranch and Fromm Farm in northwestern Bexar County, and those of you who've been involved with natural resource issues for a while, they'll be very familiar people to you. They've been very involved in these issues for a long time. So I will turn it over to Sean, and we'll start the discussion.
Thank you, Robert. My name is Sean Gerritsen. I'm with Pegasus Planning, and you're probably wondering why a guy who is a community and economic development consultant is up here talking about water. You also may be wondering, why is a guy from the city of Austin up here, and I don't work for the city of Austin, I just live in the city of Austin, talking about the Hill Country? Well, we wondered that same question, which is why we decided to have B.B. and Mary join us tonight and really give us a little bit more flavor to the presentation that I can't give because I don't live out in the Hill Country. So the other day, I was actually driving with my colleague in the Hill Country on another project, and she was looking out the window, and I asked her, I said, what are you thinking about? And she says, you know, I would love to own a ranch someday. And she's about 28 years old, and she paused for a little bit, and she says, but it would have to be close to the city. She paused a little bit longer, and she said, or I guess you could bring the city to the ranch. And I laughed, and I said, you know, you just gave me my opening for my presentation on Thursday. She says, all right, I'll give you that as long as you let the audience know that I am single and attractive and 28 years old. So I did that. But, you know, she truly does represent that demographic that is really the largest threat to the Hill Country. Because the Hill Country is such a unique and beautiful place to live in and to view, it is a draw to many, many people, myself included. I love living in Central Texas. So let me kind of lay out a couple things here for the Hill Country. What we're talking about is a 17-county region that actually includes Travis County and Bexar County, where Austin and San Antonio are, and then 15 other counties, including those in between Comal and Hays and those out west. What I was asked to do for the Hill Country Alliance was to answer two questions in a study, and we actually have a report. And this full presentation that I'm giving, for those of you who just are listening and not here in the audience, the presentation is available on the Hill Country Alliance's website, hillcountryalliance.org. But I was asked to answer, what is the population going to look like in 2030? What's the Hill Country going to look like, and what are those potential impacts to the Hill Country? That's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Our main findings, and we'll talk more about all of these, one is that the population is going to double. It's going to grow from about 2.2 million in 2000 until to almost 4.3 million in 2030. So it's almost going to double. Many say at least it's going to double. The other thing is that of the 17 counties in the Hill Country, 90% of all the land is outside the city limits. It's in what we call unincorporated area. So the counties manage the development and regulation in that. 90% of the Hill Country is unincorporated. That's a very important point to understand. The other point is that what we did is we looked at, of all the water planning that's been going on under Senate Bill 1 and Senate Bill 2, there are about four or five of those different planning efforts that touch a county in the Hill Country. We reviewed each one of those, and what we found in every one is that we do not have enough water to support the growth, period, flat out. That's the bottom line. So those three points are, if you come away from anything listening to us tonight, those are the three points I truly want you to understand. Let me back up a little bit and just kind of talk about why we are really looking at this this whole area. As we know, it's a very fragile ecosystem. We rely on the water, the groundwater, for a lot of our water sources. I'm not going to talk a lot about water. I'm not a water guy. We have a separate presentation that's going to be talking about that in a little bit. When I went to go meet with Bebe and Mary, you know, I went out there, you know, the urban guy, thinking that I kind of knew the Hill Country pretty well, and had a chance to meet with them in their ranch house that has been part of their family for years. They'll talk about in a second. And I was humbled by the experience. I came away thinking, I don't know anything about the Hill Country, and I certainly don't have any sort of environmental ethic that is comparable to what these ladies have and what many of the folks who live in the Hill Country have. And that's a very important point. Because as you have all these city dwellers that are moving out in the Hill Country, they expect the same types of amenities. They don't share the same type of environmental ethic, and that's no fault of theirs. It's just what they've grown up with, and that's very important to understand. The other real important factor about the Hill Country is tourism is a huge industry. It's a $5 billion a year industry in the Hill Country. New York Times has rated it as the number one tourist destination in the United States. There's a lot that goes into that. When I think about tourism in the Hill Country, before I started this study, I immediately would go to Schlitterbahn, the Alamo, tubing. But let's now also remember hunting and fishing are huge components. Agriculture is the number one industry in two-thirds of the Hill Country counties. Two-thirds of the counties, of the 17 counties, have agriculture as a primary industry. Let's not forget about those industries as well. And as we know, there is just an intense residential demand, and there will continue to be an intense residential demand for a lot of different reasons. In particular, the growth of our demographics in the United States is really driving that. Baby boomers make up the largest segment of the population. Texas is the second highest retirement destination in the United States behind Florida. Hill Country is the number one retirement destination in Texas. You can only expect that as baby boomers continue to grow, you will continue to become a very big retirement destination. The other thing is that you have two of the largest economies and fastest growing economies in the United States in the Hill Country with San Antonio and Austin. That's not going to change anytime in the near future. What I'd like to do is ask Bebe and Mary to talk a little bit about the background of their ranch and give us a little bit of a setting for that.
Well, I'm Mary Fenstermaker, and with my sister, we live on 140 year-old working ranch and farm in Northwest Bexar County. The Maverick Ranch, Frommy Farm, was a neighborhood of three early German homesteads. Many years ago, it was placed on the National Register of Historic Places as a district. We were listed as a district because it was unusual at the time to find an early German neighborhood under one fence line. We are located in the Balcones Canyon lands, which is the beginning of the hill country. Our ranch has tremendous biodiversity due to the convergence of three ecoregions, and it is that are rich in plants and wildlife, and we support a thriving endangered species population. The area lies over the Trinity Aquifer, which is a contributor to the Edwards Aquifer. We have pristine streams, springs. We have a creek that we really cherish that provides water to cattle and for the wildlife. Along with our home, we inherited a land ethic from our parents, grandmother, and aunt. Their work enabled us, as the present landowners, to see the land's big picture, such as water conservation, geology, the lay of the land, and the role of native plants and the animals. All of this dictates how we manage the land, such as stocking rates and the use of water. We were also taught to work with our neighbors for the benefit of all. Over 40 years ago, our family, well, when there were just a handful of mailboxes in the area, our family decided to keep the Maverick Ranch Frommy Farm as a historic district, a wildlife refuge, and absolutely no development. One of the benefits we've gotten from that decision so long ago is a nature tourism business. It is a sustainable business, and we really enjoy what we're doing. We take people wildlife watching all year long. The difficult part of, and what we didn't know, was how hard our generation would have to fight to realize our vision.
All right, thank you very much for that. And again, I just want to reiterate, it was a great experience to visit with them out on their ranch, the two wonderful ladies, and I'm very thankful they're here tonight. So where are we today with our population? In 1950, the population of the Hill Country was about 800,000. That changed over a period of 50 years to about 2.6 million in 2000, okay? So it went from about 800,000 to 2.6 million over a period of 50 years. It's going to double again in 30 years. The growth has been felt the most in certain counties, in particular those around Austin and San Antonio. Hayes County in particular, I think, grew the fastest, 45% from just 2000 to 2007, where we are today. Comal County grew 35% over that time. And what was also interesting is, of all the demographics that we've looked at, the population, the sector that grew the most was the sector, again, no surprise, 60 and above. That sector will continue to be a very fast-growing part of the region. Many different things are also changing in the Hill Country. The infrastructure not only being planned, but also being modified, as we all see it. Every roadway pretty much in the Hill Country is either planned to expand over the next 30 years or is undergoing expansion right now, whether or not it's Highway 281, 46. I took 46 from New Braunfels to get out here to Bernie tonight, and it was a little crowded, as you all recognize that. This picture, and again, those of you who are just listening to this can't see it, but it's a picture I actually grabbed off of a tourism website. And it's, you know, tourism is a great industry, and it should be promoted. But it's a funny picture, and you might not be able to read it from out there in the audience, but it basically shows 281, and it says, "Travel Texas from top to bottom on Highway 281." And why not? I've done it before. I-35 through Central Texas is the deadliest stretch of interstate in the United States. I don't know if you knew that or not. So Highway 281 will continue to be an alternative either to go travel up and down Texas or for commerce or for tourism. Infrastructure is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And let me say that again. Infrastructure planning is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you build it and they will come and they will come. So roadways, for example, they're classified by level of service, or LOS, A through D, is it? And so if you have a level of service D, for example, that means the circulation is pretty bad. It's going to be difficult for emergency vehicles to get to and fro. And so you have to expand that roadway. Well, what happens is you expand that roadway to support the existing growth, but the cars fill up that capacity. It's just like, you know, an artery that we have in our system. You open up a new artery. Don't know if that's possible. Not a doctor. Probably not. But just as an example, and the blood is going to flow that way. It's going to fill up that that area. The other thing that I really cannot talk about, and I think Bibi and Mary are going to be able to talk to it, is the loss of not only riparian habitat, that habitat along creeks and rivers, loss of watershed, which is so crucial to our water quality and water quantity, but also the loss of a lot of these historic ranches. And you'll see some of the pictures in here and in the report, if you look at that online at the Hill Country Alliance website, a lot of the pictures I took from their ranch. And all around them, you can see development. And development manifests itself in many ways, whether or not it's rooftops on top of the hills, or roadways being cut into the sides of hills. It's everywhere you look in the Hill Country. One thing that's important to understand is Texas is very far behind the majority of states in the United States in terms of the authority that they give counties and regions to plan for their growth. We do not have a vision for how we want to grow. We flat out don't have it. So I used to work at LCRA. I understand their perspective a little bit, and they will say, you know, we're required by the state to provide utilities when asked, et cetera. Well, what happens is anybody can ask for that, whether or not there's a if it's a development here or there. But there is no systematic plan for where we want to grow or how we want to grow. And that is one of those things that we'll talk about a little bit later. Tourism has continued to grow. It will continue to foster for a lot of different reasons. And the residential demand, as I mentioned, will continue to grow as well. Bibi and Mary, can you talk a little bit more about how you've seen growth over the last, say, 10 years or so, how that's impacted you?
Sure. Being in the ETJ of San Antonio means that we're directly impacted by that city, but we have no representation. Subdivisions near us and throughout the city and the area are approved one by one by the San Antonio Planning Department without looking at their impact on the community overall. Developers can completely develop out their property without providing for the problems they cause, such as impact on adjacent wells and lack of water retention, traffic congestion, and bigger utility lines. The cost of solving all this falls on the adjacent landowner and on the taxpayer. There's no zoning in the county, but developers are granted variances to build in floodplains. Then the blame for flooding is put on the open land upstream. No equity in groundwater planning seems to be around. Several years ago, citizens with Trinity Aquifer Wells worked very hard to set up a groundwater conservation district in North Bear County. We wanted to set a sustainable water level that everyone could live with. Governmental officials who should have worked with us took it away from us and put the Trinity Glen Rose Groundwater District into the hands of developers. Right now, they are approaching setting a drawdown in Northwest Bear County and all of North Bear County, which would virtually stop a spring flow and cause lots of wells to go dry. This is referred to as desired future conditions by state legislation, but in Bear County is based on out-of-date data, and in Northwest Bear County on no data at all. If groundwater districts don't use critical data like droughts of record and provide for sustainable water levels, spring flow and wells will go dry, and the Hill Country will be deeply in trouble. So our water table most definitely has fallen. We know that by measuring our wells. We've lost our view sheds just 3 miles away from us. As Sean was talking about, 300 to 400 feet were dynamited and quarried off several thousand acres of hills, absolutely moonscaped, and then covered with houses. The land was grandfathered, so the developer had the right to remove every living thing. It looks like of a West Virginia strip mine. We now have tremendous air pollution. We see the loss of wildlife and wildlife diversity. There's a desperate need for wildlife corridors when roads bisect a wildlife crossing. And when habitat is destroyed by development, most of the displaced wildlife die. A few of those species who do manage to coexist become pests to the very ones who displace them. We see exotic invasive plants now appearing in our pastures, and we don't understand why people insist on planting water-greedy invasives. There's a lot more night light I can read outside. Trespassing and poaching continue. We've always had it, but it's probably a little bit more. And most sinister of all is eminent domain, which certainly arrived with all of this.
Thank you. You know, there are a lot of states that actually do regulate how high on a hill you can build. And, you know, we obviously don't do that here in Texas. There are a couple of counties in the hill country who have actually not relatively recently passed regulations to try and stem that night light that we all see out in the hill country. So our population, as we kind of look towards 2030, it's going to double in nearly every county in the hill country. Now, I need to also say that the data that we used for this was the Texas Water Development Board data, which is the same data that's used for a lot of planning efforts. However, you know, we can very clearly say that that data is already surpassed in many counties. So the projections that are being used for planning our water and et cetera are, in my opinion and in the opinion of many who actually are involved in population projections, underestimates. Edwards County, for example, Real County, for example, they show both of those counties losing population over the next 30 years. That they could very well lose certain segments of their population. I disagree that they're going to lose the absolute number, and I think that number is going to increase. Bandera, Kendall County, you will be above 50,000 population at least by 2030. Comal County is going to be above 200,000. Hays County is going to be above 300,000. So we started taking a look at, all right, how can we truly quantify this impact? What is this truly going to look like? And, you know, it was a challenging project. We did a couple of things. For those of you who are just listening to this in the audience, and rather than viewing this on the presentation, what I'm showing now are two aerial images of the same place on two different times, one in 1995 and one in 2005. This is along 290, real close to between Nutty Brown Road and Dripping Springs. And you can see the differences from 1995, where there were slated or planned subdivisions, versus 2005. The obvious dramatic change in the landscape. We took it a step further, and we looked at one county in particular, which is Blanco County. In Blanco County, there were a couple things that really popped up to us. First of all, we got a map that shows all of the subdivisions that exist right now in Blanco County. And what we found is that of the 37,000 acres that are devoted to subdivisions, only 3,500 of those acres are actually in city limits. The rest is in the unincorporated area. We also looked at, okay, in Blanco County, what's the population today? How much, what is the per capita amount of acreage that's been used for development? And we found that to be right around 4 acres per capita. So we extrapolated that, very simple, basic kind of math. And it actually, 4 acres per person is very similar to some other studies we've taken a look at that have been done in the past. What we found is that if this same pattern continues, by 2030, Blanco County will have about another 22,000 acres developed. Now, what I will tell you is that alone sounds like a pretty stark amount. And that red square that, again, those in the audience can see it, those who are listening, there's a rectangular or square that's on Blanco County's map that is it represents a pretty significant amount of all of Blanco County. So, again, we found that to be pretty stark and scary. Even scarier, though, however, is that there's already a 6,000-acre development that's planned in Blanco County, already has water rights for 10,000 people, and that is one quarter of those 22,000 acres. So our estimate is that 22,000 acres is probably an underestimate of how much acreage is actually going to be devoted to land development over the next 20 years. I don't even want to show you the map that we also developed that showed, all right, if we took this model out to the entire Hill Country area, how much acreage would we look at? Pretty much the entire square took over the entire Hill Country area, and it was a scary thought. What are these impacts of growth? When we talk about the impacts, we really categorize them into a couple different areas. Culture, What's the impact on the culture? What's the impact on the economy? And what's the impact on the natural resources? Natural resources is relatively easy to gauge that impact. The economy, what we've talked about with the Hill Country Alliance is probably worthwhile for the Hill Country Alliance or other groups to look at what is going to be the very real impact on tourism, for example, on different aspects of tourism, hunting, fishing, the wine industry, et cetera. The character of the Hill Country is a much more difficult thing to define and to quantify. But as somebody mentioned to me recently, we're kind of talking about killing the goose that laid the golden egg. When you think about the reason people are coming out in the Hill Country is for the very Hill Country itself, the beauty, the aesthetics, the rolling hills, and they don't quite understand that a lot of folks who are moving out there are at the same time destroying the same aesthetics that they came out for. And that's I think, an important thing to understand. The other thing is what we call cost of services. There has been several different studies that have looked at the cost of services. And what that means is how much money does it take for a public sector entity, a city, a school district, et cetera, a county, to provide services, whether or not that's EMS or water or wastewater, to a residential development, to a commercial development, or to agriculture. And what those studies show is that largely residential development does not pay for itself. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that. And most of the studies come up right around the same numbers. So for commercial development, for every commercial development, to service commercial development, it takes about 30 cents per every dollar of tax revenue you get out of commercial development. For agricultural ranch land, it costs about 35 cents per every dollar of revenue. For residential development, it costs about $1.26 for every dollar of revenue generated by residential development. It does not pay for itself. And this is a big issue for those in the public sector to fully understand. When you have most of the development occurring out in the unincorporated area, the cost to service that growth is going to be much higher than a more compact type of scenario. There was a national study that looked at this, and the cost savings with a more compact kind of development versus the typical kind of sprawl that we get is almost half of the cost savings that it would take to provide services to residential development. B.B. Mary, what has been, of all the impacts you've seen, what would you say are some of the larger impacts you've seen of the residential growth?
Well, first of all, Sean, I'll have to say that all the impacts that are coming towards us are what come from no planning, no regional planning. And the impacts that we've discussed so far have all been enabled by eminent domain. Eminent domain is used to raise more tax base for your local by your local governments. It's used to move land from valuable open space into development. It covers up the awful results of no planning. Eminent domain abuses the landowners, destroys their homes, and doesn't pay them for what their property is worth. The five eminent domain runs at us include a six-lane road right through the middle of us, started by developers who bought land, then donated some right-of-way, and then pushed it onto the farmers and ranchers. Another was a substation and huge power lines, which were to serve another area, not ours. The latest and craziest is a dam. From the city of San Antonio, the county of Bexar, and the San Antonio River Authority. Its proposed location at the tip-top of the watershed would only succeed in flooding us out. It wouldn't do a thing downstream. Since open land holds and slowly releases rainwater, and concrete doesn't even absorb water, to promote elimination of open space in favor of more concrete slabs jeopardizes public health and safety downstream. I'm saying this because we've been told several times that if we would sell to developers, there would be no dam.
And there's some good impacts, too, from all this terrible stuff. We've met many concerned people, and they've organized to educate themselves and the public and promote good solutions. They're working area-wide for inclusion in water and open space issues and for regional planning. and we thought we'd give you just a quick rundown of a few of the local issues. We're working to establish a sustainable, desired future condition for the Trinity Aquifer, if that's possible. A road, we're working to hold a road back that crosses the Edwards and Trinity Aquifers and their recharge zones, also going through endangered species habitat, which is being pushed as a hazardous material route for the Homeland Security's National Bio and Ag Defense Lab facility on the west side of San Antonio. The dangerous diseases there, plus an accident, could devastate the livestock, hunting, and related industries in 48 hours. A local water purveyor is wanting to provide sewer service to Northwest Bexar County, but the sewer lines would go up the creeks of Northwest Bexar County. The result? Well, look at the concrete ditches in San Antonio. They used to be creeks just like ours. Our pristine creeks recharge the Edwards Aquifer. Irate citizens in neighboring counties are opposing efforts by the same purveyor to take their water. There are huge power lines built across the beautiful hills, but which don't service the area. The move to dam up and channelize our pristine creeks by the three entities that are presently coming at us are the same entities who are now admitting that the channelized San Antonio River needs to be corrected. A permit for a sewage treatment plant to daily discharge thousands of gallons of effluent treated to a recreational level into San Geronimo Creek, just a few miles above a major Edwards Aquifer recharge feature, and also above heritage ranchers whose families drink the water of that creek, and, of course, a quarry in Medina County to daily use hundreds of thousands of gallons of Edwards water to wash the gravel, coupled with an application for a railroad spur to bisect the historic town of Quihee and go through three floodplains. We also are working to try to do something about unregulated airfields in our area. These groups are doing amazing work, so they're the positive end of this. They're wonderful citizens, and you might call them heroes. They see the big picture. They know what's wrong. All these issues are happening because of no cohesive, sustainable regional planning. John?
Thank you. You know, and I want to again thank you for being a part of this presentation. I know this city boy really thinks that that you've enhanced this presentation with the flavor of your thoughts and ideas. I want to leave you with just a couple of things, and then we have another presentation to go on to. A lot of you may be wondering, well, what can we do about this? I hope that we have kind of provided a little shock value to realize that our region is going to be growing exponentially, doubling in population. The impacts are going to be tremendous on our culture and on our economy and our natural resources. There are some things that, absent additional regulatory authority, we can do, such as some of the things are being done right now, habitat conservation plans, transfer or purchase of development rights. City comprehensive plans, in my opinion, is the one area that we need to focus on more. I believe the cities should try and figure out a way to absorb more of the projected population within their city limits. It will ultimately save those taxpayers money instead of providing services, which they ultimately will have to those developments outside of the city limits. I think the one big thing, though, is we have got to have better regional planning. We have to be provided authority to develop these regional plans and actually implement those plans. Utility providers need to be a part of it. Where are the utilities going to go? Where are the roadways going to go? What are the areas we want to protect? And let's move forward with that. I want to thank you all very much. I think we're going to be here for some discussion in a little bit. And, again, I hope we provide a little shock value to you. Thank you.
Thanks to all three of you on that very interesting presentation. And we're going to be now shifting to talking about population growth to really talking about some of our water resources that are affected by population growth. But as we start to make that shift, I wanted to provide just a little bit of background for you on some of the water policy situation in Texas or water law situation that makes it complicated to work with the population growth and protect the natural resources, the water resources of the area. First of all, I think if you've worked around water very long, you know that Texas is fairly unique in that we have two separate legal systems for groundwater and for surface water. most states, or at least most western states, regulate them in an integrated fashion, recognizing that often surface water becomes groundwater and vice versa, so you look at it holistically and you regulate it holistically. In Texas, for various historical reasons, we look at them entirely separately. Our surface water resources are regulated centrally by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, and they give out permits for using surface water. If you want to use water from a lake or from a river, you've got to go to the state agency. Groundwater is exactly the opposite. Groundwater is generally available to the landowner, traditionally through something called the rule of capture. That's begun to be regulated a bit through groundwater districts, and those groundwater districts tend to be local, as opposed to surface water permitting centrally. Groundwater permitting, if done at all, is done locally. What makes it particularly interesting in planning for population growth and getting enough water for population growth is that it really you have almost a mirror image in where you can move water from. You would think that surface water being regulated centrally would be available statewide, but in fact, state law basically does not allow you to take water from one watershed to another because that transfer makes it a junior water right. So basically there's a strong policy statement in state law that surface water has a strong preference for staying locally. Groundwater, even though it's regulated locally, is not allowed to be restricted from being sold around the state. So you have small groundwater districts, oftentimes underfunded and understaffed, with tremendous demand on them from people that want to move that water elsewhere and have the legal right to do it. So you've got a kind of a funny situation in Texas. Surface water regulated centrally, but can really be used only locally or regionally. Groundwater regulated locally, but can be transferred anywhere statewide. This creates a real interesting situation in trying to figure out how we're going to supply water for the projected population growth and how we're going to have water for our natural resources that Chad's going to tell you about now. Our next speaker is Chad Norris. He's an aquatic biologist with Texas Parks and Wildlife, and he's working on an update on the classic springs of Texas.
Thank you, Robert. Perhaps no resource defines the Texas Hill Country as much as its water resources do, the spring-fed creeks and rivers that I'm sure y'all have enjoyed or in some form or fashion. Increased demands placed on our groundwater resources by the rapidly growing population that Sean has spoken about has led to predictions that many of our aquifers will experience significant declines in groundwater levels. And this has also created much concern over potential impacts to surface water habitats that are dependent upon groundwater, such as springs. Now, springs are the natural outlets of our aquifers. They're commonly defined as the natural flow of groundwater to the land surface or to a surface water body. I think this is important to point out. Most of us will think of springs as a defined orifice, such as we see in the Hill Country. But in many cases, especially in East Texas and down along the Gulf Coast, there are also springs that enter directly into the stream bed that we don't see, but they essentially work in much the same way, providing flows to our creeks and rivers. Now, springs may emerge in many different ways, from an apparent defined orifice or discreetly into a stream bed, as I said. The characteristics of a particular spring is going to largely be defined by its hydrogeologic setting. Now, by the characteristics, I mean the quantity and quality of water it produces, the habitat types it forms, and its reliability as a water source. Now, when I say the hydrogeologic setting, I'm referring to the parent material of that aquifer. Is it made of limestone? Is it made of sand or gravel? That directly affects the ability of that aquifer to receive, store, and transmit the water. In the Texas Hill Country, one of our aquifers that covers much of the western portion is the Edwards Trinity Plateau Aquifer. Now, this is a limestone aquifer. Recharge is occurring primarily in fractures, faults, and sinkhole-type features. These features gradually enlarge over time as water continues to enter them and dissolve away the limestone. So water movement into the aquifer occurs relatively quickly. Your recharge is quick. The residence times are short. You have a relatively low filtration capacity in terms of water quality and cleaning up that water. And the discharge from these springs can be much more variable than from those that issue from a sand or a gravel aquifer. So these characteristics have a tremendous impact or implications on the management of these aquifers, especially in terms of drought management and trying to address environmental concerns, especially those related to springs. Now, the foundation of knowledge on Texas springs is based on the work of one gentleman, Gunnar Bruhn. He was a geologist for the Texas Water Development Board, and one report he produced was on the major and historical springs of Texas. This is Report 189 that can be found on the Texas Water Development Board's website. It has some great information, basic information about springs and how they work. In this report, Bruhn documented and described 281 major and historical springs that he visited. At the time that he visited these in the late 1970s, 65 of these major and historical springs no longer flowed. Many of these springs were where towns had grown up around, and they were also where historic trails used to run through. So these, basically what Gunnar Bruhn did here was document the loss and decline of our Texas springs for the first time. After retiring from the Texas Water Development Board, Gunnar Bruhn self-published Springs of Texas Volume 1. In this book, he documented and described roughly 2,000 springs. This book was out of print for a long period of time and has recently been reissued by Texas A&M Press, so you can obtain this book again if you're interested. However, this is not as comprehensive as it might sound, being titled Springs of Texas. Gunnar Bruhn only visited 183 of our 254 counties. He missed 71 of them that sort of form a large donut around Travis County. So he missed some real gems like Bandera and Real counties that have a lot of springs in them. Now, much of the info that is included in this book is relatively limited. It's pretty much a really brief description and perhaps one flow measurement from the 1970s. And this is pretty much the extent of what we know about most of the springs in the state. Nobody's really gone back out and tried to look at many of these springs. And actually, that's currently what we are trying to do, both in my work at Parks and Wildlife and in trying to update Springs of Texas Volume 2. Now, there are many reasons why we are concerned about documenting and conserving the remaining springs in Texas. Springs have long been recognized as a valuable cultural, natural, and ecological resource. They were used extensively by Native Americans, and their location often determined the location of trails and towns and many of our major cities. We now recognize the importance of springs in many other ways. Their direct window into the health of our aquifers, their expression at the surface or the lack thereof reflects the prevailing climatic and hydrologic conditions in a particular watershed, as well as the land management practices that are occurring in that watershed. So overall, springs are a good barometer of the health of our watersheds. Springs are also a source of high quality water to the receiving water basin. This is important in terms of maintaining our water quality standards. Springs also serve as a water source for terrestrial wildlife, including large and small mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and an assortment of wildlife. This importance is perhaps most pronounced in western Texas, where it's extremely arid and springs are often the only perennial source of water. Springs are also recognized as unique aquatic habitats that sustained a high degree of diversity. I'll come back to this point in a minute. But perhaps the most significant aspects of springs is the role that they play in the natural flow regime of many of our streams and rivers. And I will also come back to that point. I'd like to talk more and focus on those two attributes of springs just a little bit more. As I said, springs often sustain a high degree of diversity. This is including the flora and fauna that are found not only in the aquatic habitat but in the surrounding canyons. They commonly include a very high proportion of rare and endemic species, but they also harbor very widespread and common species. As compared to ponds, lakes, or streams, springs are thermally and hydrologically stable habitats. So these are going to be winter warm and summer cool habitats, and they're often perennial in nature, where many streams and lakes and ponds tend to dry up. Many of these rare and endemic species, such as round-nosed minnows and green-throat darters and the plateau shiner, are restricted and adapted to spring habitats. So these guys have evolved in these habitats, and there are Texas natives essentially in these spring habitats. As springs continue to decline, the future of such species is uncertain. It seems likely they will become increasingly rare. For more widespread and common species, such as largemouth bass or the central stone roller or long-eared sunfish, springs serve as a refuge during environmental extremes, such as droughts or floods. In some of the sampling work that we've done, we tend to find a higher diversity of fish following flood events and also during drought. So what that indicates to me is that many of these fish are moving up into these habitats during drought times to escape the higher flows and seek a little refuge. And similarly, during dry times, as the streams dry up downstream, they'll move up into these springs and they can find refuge from these extremes, and hopefully individuals that survive there can then repopulate downstream habitats. So essentially, springs are important in keeping our common species common. Now, similar to the fish community, aquatic macroinvertebrates are a very diverse community that are commonly found and inhabit springs. These also consist of rare, endemic, and common species. But these bugs play an important role ecologically in terms of the processing of organic matter and as a food source for fish and other higher trophic levels within the system. Now, as I said earlier, perhaps the most important role of springs in their contribution to the natural flow regime, is their contribution to the natural flow regime, but more specifically, it's to the low flow portion of our natural flow regime. They provide the base flows that sustain our rivers, streams, and creeks during drought. So essentially, springs are the difference between having perennial water bodies and intermittent water bodies. And I'll get back to this point a little bit later, because this is probably the biggest implication in Texas, or at least in the hill country, with these limestone aquifers. I don't think that we will see long-term declines like you see in aquifers such as the Ogallala that recharge very slowly. I think what we'll see is that creeks and streams that didn't dry up in the past will begin to dry up somewhat, and over time, as we develop water resources or groundwater resources more, the period of time that they dry up will extend and be longer. And there's tremendous ecological and economic impacts associated with that. Now, the base flows produced by springs are a historically reliable water supply to downstream creeks, rivers, and reservoirs for domestic, livestock, agricultural, municipal, recreational, and other uses. Now, because surface water is appropriated based on the historical record, so in other words, when they appropriate water for one of these various uses, whether it's municipal or agricultural uses or whatever it may be, they go back and they look at the historical stream flow record. Well, to the extent that springs have contributed to that stream flow record, as spring flows diminish, so will the reliability of those water rights. And there are tremendous implications, again, with that economically. Diminished spring flows will also have implications to the recharge of downslope aquifers and as far as property values for private landowners along spring-fed creeks. You know, a piece of property that has a live perennial water body on it is worth a lot more than one with a dry creek, that's for sure. With all the important attributes of springs that I just mentioned, the conservation of springs should be a priority for the state. However, there are many issues with trying to conserve these resources and maintain the base flows that they provide. Of course, a vast majority of our state is on private property, so a majority of our springs that feed our creeks and streams are also on private property. This creates issues with not only gaining access and having to work with landowners, but also complicates research and conservation efforts, as rarely are the spring source and the hydrogeologic features that feed that spring on the same property. So in order to truly conserve springs and have successful efforts, we'll have to focus on that entire system and likely work with many landowners across a broad area. Perhaps the most important aspect to conserving springs is the sustainable use of our aquifers where feasible. The word sustainable has been used many times here today, and I've heard various definitions of it at many meetings I've been to. Many believe a sustainable level of groundwater pumping is to set pumping equal to the average recharge of an aquifer. However, this ultimately results in zero natural discharge. If you can imagine a 55-gallon drum that's full of water, say you cut a hole in the top and you cut a hole in the bottom, if you turned on a spigot and it's losing water at the same rate that it's filling, it's in some sort of a state of equilibrium. And that's much the same thing with our aquifers prior to man poking holes with wells in them, that they were in over the long term in a state of equilibrium with recharge roughly equaling discharge. Well, if you can imagine that 55-gallon barrel then getting a bunch of straws poked in it, sucking water out, eventually your discharge is going to go to zero. So it's really not a sustainable means of managing an aquifer to set your groundwater pumping equal to the average recharge. I tend to define sustainability as the use of a resource that not only meets current needs, but it's also going to still be available for future generations to meet their needs, but with an acceptable level of impacts. Now, what is an acceptable level of impacts, I think, is something that has to be determined locally and by the citizens of the state. Personally, that's something that I think is very important for people to be involved with these decisions. Unfortunately, in Texas, we offer little to no protection for springs, and we manage and appropriate groundwater and surface water separately, as if they were separate entities, as Robert pointed out. And that's just not the case in reality. So in light of these issues, how can we conserve springs? What can we do? I hate to leave on a negative note and just make it look like springs are going to decline and there's not much we can do. I think it's important to get out and document more springs and gather baseline data. Of course, that's what I'm doing, so perhaps that's a little job security speaking there. But I think it's important for us to gather more information on the remaining springs. I think we need to identify the major outlets of our aquifers at a minimum and identify those hydrogeologic features that feed them. It should be a priority to study such major features. Providing incentives to landowners, I think, will be key to getting buy-in from the public on such things. And providing the incentives to these landowners for being good stewards of the land, I think, is also very important, because essentially they're the ones that are helping us get water into our aquifers by managing the grasslands and prairies and hilltops the best they can. Ultimately, we also need to do a better job of addressing the connection between groundwater and surface water in terms of policy and planning. In doing some of these things, we can hopefully conserve the springs that I believe are so vital to the ecological and economic health of the hill country and the state as a whole. And I just personally cannot imagine the hill country without the creeks and streams that, as I said, I think are one of the defining characteristics of it. And with that, I'll pass it back to Robert Potts.
Thank you, Chad. But again, just to provide a little bit of background for you as you're thinking through your questions and the types of things you want to discuss with the panel, let me briefly describe to you how Texas does its water planning. We've referred to it several times about the planning process. We've referred several times to the need to do more planning. Actually, in the water planning sphere, Texas is considered to be one of the leaders in thinking about water for the future. Back a number of years, about 10 years ago, in the state legislature, they required that the state be divided up into about 16 different planning regions, and that these planning regions be create a planning team that is made up of a cross-section of people from the region, people representing small business, river authorities, groundwater districts, small cities, big cities, agricultural interests, and others. And so for the last, more than 10 years now, these teams have met working on planning for that region. And what the law requires is that the Water Development Board, as was referred to earlier, tell the region what the projected population increase is every decade for about 50 years in that region. The Water Development Board tells the regional planning team what the average per capita water use is for the population there, and then what the water supplies are currently in place. So you can see, okay, you've got this much demand currently, you've got this much supply currently. Presumably at current times you've got more supply than you've got demand. And then if you follow it on through, you can see what the demand will be over the next 50 years. And then the planning team is supposed to come up with projects that are supposed to meet the difference between the projected demand and the current supply. And they adopt, by vote, those projects. Now, the planning teams don't really have any legal authority. This is merely a planning exercise, but it does have some weight in that it's much easier to get permits for water projects if they've been approved by the local planning region. And it's also easier to get financing from the Water Development Board if they've been approved. It's a bottom-up planning effort for water resources. Obviously, there are a lot of problems with it, not the least of which is what we've already talked about with the kind of disjointed nature of legal rights under groundwater and surface water. But just so you know that there is at least this going on, has been going on for about three different cycles. And Texas has actually gotten a fair amount of commendation around the country and even around the world for doing this type of planning process as being a bottom-up. There are flaws in it. It's based on good data, whether you're accurately know what the population is going to be. And it's not always clear that all the plans, all the projects that are adopted by the planning teams are, in fact, feasible to be done. But that is the process that's undergone in Texas. So with that little bit of background and these great presentations about the springs and the water resources and about the population growth and the impact it has on landowners, we want to open this up to your questions, and we'll do the best we can to answer them. So we have a microphone here. If you would please step up to the microphone. If there's a line, we'll be glad to get to you all. Or we can pass it around. That'll be fine, too.
Yeah, this is a question for Chad. You talked about the need for an assessment of groundwater usage on springs. And I guess the question in my mind, doesn't the groundwater availability model that is being used provide, at least on a gross basis, some estimate of the impact of the aquifer level on spring flow?
It does look at the grid cells on this model are pretty coarse. They're a mile by a mile wide. So you cannot look at a particular spring or necessarily even a certain reach of a river. But within that mile-by-mile grid, you can look at overall gains or losses from the aquifer to the stream or vice versa. So those groundwater availability model runs can provide you with some insight in terms of how you're altering that gradient between groundwater and surface water.
I have one other question, and that is, in the first presentation, you talked about some of the things that are available to us as far as addressing the growth issues in the Hill Country. One thing you listed was parcel database, and I don't know what that is.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I didn't address it. When we started doing our study, what ideally we would have loved to have seen was every appraisal district, and in Texas, appraisal districts basically are the same geographic area as counties. So every county appraisal district, we are hoping to get digital parcel data for every county. They don't have it. That does not exist right now. In an ideal world, we'd be able to, some counties do, but not every county. I'd say about a quarter of all the counties in the 17-county area have that. Ideally, we'd love to have historical data and current data on parcels, because only that way, say, for example, if we had digital parcel data for every county in the region in 2000 and 2007, then we'd be able to do some great analysis and understand really what the difference in parcel size has been over that time period and how that sort of fragmentation has occurred. So Hill Country Alliance, I think, has just recently spoken with a graduate program who's actually going to be trying to do that over the next year, which I think is a great, great project for the Hill Country Alliance.
Actually, my question is about development, but naturally, development depends on the available water. And I know GMA-9 has been working with developing the model for the Texas Water Development Board, which is due in 2010. But there has been resistance to include the drought of record, which was 1950 to 57. And when you don't include that, you lose a lot of data that leaves you feeling that there's a lot more water available than there may be during droughts. That drought of record, when they try to run the model, leaves a lot of the program crashes because it comes up with empty cells. Empty cells mean springs that don't flow. So we know that with the population growth, that we should include the drought of record to ensure that there will be available water during those periods of time. Now, finally getting to my question, If you look at what has happened, in, as you say, 90% of the county is undeveloped at this time, and if we don't have management of the growth in those areas, it certainly is going to result in more and more demand on our water. Our county commissioners have for years been crying for a way to manage development in the county. In the city, it does well. The city managers do quite well in managing growth. But our counties have essentially no power to regulate development. How, and you say we need to do that. And my question is, how do you recommend that we approach giving our county commissioners more authority? And obviously the question is the legislature. I understand that. But they have not been able to do that for several years. What steps do you recommend they take to get that authority?
So the question, and Sean may pitch this to you first, how do you recommend that this planning happen?
I'd be happy to address that. Just one point of clarification. You mentioned that 90% of the region is undeveloped. It's actually 90% of the region is in unincorporated areas, which is, I think, similar to what you're trying to say. Excuse me. You know, I used to work at a council of government. I used to work at CAPCOG, if you're familiar with that, that does regional planning. And I've been I've been one of those regional advocates for many, many years. And you're right, every legislative session that I've ever been involved in or witnessed, there's always a couple of bills that are introduced to try and get more enabling legislation for counties. And what's important to understand the difference between cities and counties is that the legislature has given cities a lot of broad authority. They have given counties can only do specifically what the state says they can do and nothing more. So the issue, and really I think one of the real drivers behind this study, is we feel that more people need to understand what these potential impacts are going to be on the Hill Country, because without a larger advocacy group that is approaching the state legislators that are within the Hill Country and outside the Hill Country, that we're going to continue to face the same issue every legislative session. So I guess the real answer is with more people that truly understand these issues and that are going to be strong advocates, I think we'll have a lot more success. And I wanted to mention also that on the Hill Country Alliance website, hillcountryalliance.org, you can register there to receive emails from them. Many of you might already receive their emails, but anytime there is a legislative session coming up, for example, you'll get notifications about that. If there's other studies that are done, you'll get notification about that. So I strongly encourage you to send that web link out to a lot of your friends who might not currently be familiar with Hill Country Alliance.
Bibi or Mary, do you have any thoughts about that issue?
Well, I know it's been an issue with the counties, and several of the legislators have attempted in the past to get the law changed, but somebody seems to always be there in the counties before anybody can get there to get them to change their minds. But I think if the counties who historically have voted against the law change would just look at what's coming towards them, because we are the example of what's coming. They might change their minds and be in favor of some kind of planning and power given to the counties.
Well, I think there is an attempt. There will be an attempt in this upcoming legislature to put a bill forward for the Hill Country counties. We hope that passes.
Chad, do you have any thoughts on that?
I was just going to mention what Bibi had said. I'd heard there was efforts for the 15 Hill Country counties to band together, and I think there's got to be strength in numbers. I'm a biologist, so I, if I had the answer to that one, I'd probably make a lot more money.
One other just kind of clarification. You've heard tonight reference several times to GMAs. I apologize. We sometimes fall into to kind of water speak. GMA stands for groundwater management area, and the GMA process was set up a couple of legislative sessions ago. As I mentioned earlier, most groundwater districts are very small. Most are, in fact, single county groundwater districts. And, of course, aquifers are typically much larger than counties and are not particularly aligned by political boundaries like counties are. So the legislature, in order to address the concern that you might have, say, one county sharing an aquifer with a neighboring county, and that one county issues lots of permits for pumping while the neighboring county doesn't, and the resource is adversely affected, grouped groundwater districts together and brought them together to plan for their aquifers. And they're divided into groundwater management areas. Groundwater management area 9 has gotten a lot of attention recently. But that's what's referred to when you hear about GMA and desired future conditions, because what the legislature asked the groundwater management areas to do was to say, okay, this is the condition we want our aquifer to be in. And they can define that. Is it these springs flowing? Or up in the Ogallala Aquifer in the Panhandle, their desired future condition is basically only so much drawdown over the next few years. They know their aquifer is going to be falling. They're trying to limit how much it does fall. It's up to the local groundwater management areas to figure that out. That process is ongoing. We're supposed to get those reports back over the next several years, but it's something that's definitely worth watching and participating in if you can. So, yes, ma'am, you have a question? Would you take the microphone?
Are there other areas in Texas, or this is a great one, the Ogallala, or in the United States where the citizens have taken these measures to protect their water systems, and perhaps for a future water program that you're going to be having, you might share with us who has done it and how they did it and how we might follow their example?
Okay. Anybody on the panel want
to? I'm not sure I totally got the question.
She was asking of examples of success.
Who's done what we're trying to do, and how do they get it done, and how might we follow their
example? There are different examples, and with water, I don't know that you can point to very many that are completely successful. One that I've been involved with and is certainly related to this area that has been, I think, at least partially successful has been the Edwards Aquifer Authority. And that was forced to be happened because of an endangered species lawsuit. And because there were endangered species that lived in the springs in San Marcos and New Braunfels that were fed by the Edwards Aquifer, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the federal courts basically forced the state of Texas to permit water from the Edwards Aquifer. And the permitting process took a long time, but it's already had a positive effect in the sense that there's less water used. And a good example of that, if you look in 1999 and compare pumping from the Edwards Aquifer to 2005, they were both very dry years, both very similar years. And what we found is that in 1999, when there was no permitting yet, it wasn't in place, we used 14% more water than we did in 2005. Even though the population had grown in those intervening 6 years by 12%. The only difference between those years, aside from more population, was you actually had permits in place that made people start thinking about and restricting their use. So, you know, that's not a complete success. There are a lot of issues that still happen and are still buzzing around the Edwards Aquifer, but it's an example of that if you do put a regulatory system in place, you can reduce pressure on your water resources.
Part of the issue, too, is Texas is about the only state that has the rule of capture. For all the other states, groundwater is state water, and therefore it's regulated that way. So there's not a ground-up protection on the part of the citizens to protect it in the way that you're suggesting.
And if I may, beyond water, there are a lot of states that plan for the growth a heck of a lot better than Texas. A couple of them that are sort of seen as models, at least in my field and planning field, Florida, believe it or not, North Carolina, Oregon, Colorado to some degree. But, you know, there's always unintended consequences with any sort of planning effort that you do. And as an example of that, Oregon has what they call urban growth boundaries. and it basically says that you cannot, the city cannot grow their boundaries anymore within a certain time period, and ultimately it's about preserving what's outside of those boundaries. The problem with that, though, is it really drives up the cost of housing, because it's a supply and demand issue. It really drives up the cost of housing inside those urban growth boundaries. So, you know, I mean, whenever Texas does give counties authority, obviously, if you're going to have a regional growth plan, affordable housing and how you're going to address that has got to be kind of a paramount issue to address as part of that overall package.
If I could say something here, I know in terms of water development, there are certainly other states that are much more stringent in terms of making people who are seeking appropriations, whether it's groundwater or surface water, they put the burden of investigating those interactions between the groundwater and surface water on the person who's seeking that appropriation, and they essentially make them prove. One example that I have is in Pennsylvania. These folks were looking to take about 10 gallons per minute from a 90 gallon per minute spring. This was an example that I saw at a groundwater meeting in New Mexico. The applicant who was seeking that water had to spend over $300,000 to prove that their extraction of 10 gallons per minute of that spring would not have a significant impact on surface water. Now, for 10 gallons per minute, maybe $300,000 is a bit much, but I don't think it's out of the question or unreasonable to put that burden on people who are going to profit off of that resource.
You know, and I'll say also that, you know, I mean, just following this whole issue of growth management over the last 10 years in Central Texas, 10 years ago, it was very much about environmentalists and ranchers against developers. And I've seen such a difference in that change over the last 10 years where a lot of developers are now joining the ranks of environmental groups and advocacy groups. And I think that's a good thing. And I think that it's important to say that there are still good developers out here. Unfortunately, it's not the majority. And I think we've made a lot of headway towards that. And again, I think education and advocacy really does a lot to kind of change the mindsets of people. And you know, study after study shows that conservation development and, you know, where you cluster housing and preserve certain areas, you actually get a higher return on your investment than the standard type of development. The other thing I'll say on that is what's ironic is that if there was a very systematic plan for water and wastewater, then subdivisions could be much more compact. Because of our requirements for septic tanks, for example, and with the size of tracts that you have, that without centralized water and wastewater, it's going to be very difficult for a lot of developments to have smaller lots. There's the irony in that, in my opinion.
Yes, ma'am.
Every now and then we hear that they're controlling groundwater pumping if you're a commercial operation. And then I've heard people with the state say, well, sooner or later, you'll have some controls over personal groundwater pumping. Does Hill Country Alliance know about anything like that, that the state might come in and actually start putting meters on groundwater use? Because living near a river, you get pretty worried about all the wells that people are poking into the ground.
So this, you're asking about the...
Do you know of any state plans to start controlling more groundwater?
You mean monitoring individual domestic wells? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
I haven't heard anything along those lines. I think that we're, in the state as a whole, we're having enough trouble getting grasp on the large water users trying to put meters on every domestic well. I don't see that as being a feasible option in the future.
And currently, domestic and livestock wells are exempt from metering by state law. And so it would require a change in state law, and I've heard no discussion about changing that for domestic and livestock wells.
But it might be important to know how much water actually that is taking. Well, that's what they say, but it would be good to know what that figure actually is.
Yes.
Chad, you mentioned incentives to landowners for spring flow protection. Could you give some examples for that?
Well, I believe financial assistance for some of the land clearing projects and for just undertaking good best management land management practices, such as rotational grazing or fencing off riparian zones, whether that's tax breaks or just a matching money of some kind. I think that goes a long way. Many of the landowners that I've met with and been fortunate to go out and see the springs on their property, they're still trying to make a living off the land. They're still running cattle, and they don't have much money to undertake a lot of these activities. Maybe prescribed burns, fencing off a few pastures so you can do more rotational grazing. It's not cheap, and it's not easy work to take care of some of these large ranches, and unfortunately, it's a tale that I hear a lot. It's pretty hard for a lot of these folks just to hold on to what they have, let alone undertake new projects and try to essentially do the right thing, even though many of them know it is the right thing. They just don't have the financial means.
And that can actually be a very critical component of water supply. What we're learning now, riparian science is really in its infancy, but what we're learning is that healthy riparian areas serve as sponges. And during high flow times, they'll suck up the water, and then they will gradually release it during low flow times. But most of our rivers and streams are highly degraded and don't really serve as effective sponges. So there's some real opportunities through the right types of programs to enhance our riparian areas that would not only help the landowner, because they would have a healthier piece of property, but also would help all the city folks that depend on that river or that creek for water supply. So there's some real options there through good land management.
Appreciate the opportunity to speak. Over the last decade, I've had the privilege of learning a little bit about how TCEQ works in affecting water quality. I think they do a very poor job because they're very limited in the things that they can do. While we're talking to our legislatures about how we can protect or provide proper water quantity for areas, I think we also ought to ask them about giving TCEQ more authority. If you read their, shall I say, mission that they're required to do for the state of Texas, it's to protect the air and water quality of the state of Texas, comma, consistent with good business practices. However, these good business practices almost always are related to what a licensed engineer will sign off on a water pollution abatement plan or on air quality plans. TCEQ rarely is able to follow up and check out these things. When the plan is submitted, it's essentially passed with a rubber stamp. For example, on wastewater disposal plants, you can have a town meeting about it or a public hearing on it, public meeting on it. Suggest things such as dye trace studies be performed if they're going to dump it into a creek. And yet the water wastewater abatement plant is approved without any of these studies being done. And this is into the Edwards Aquifer, Robert.
You have a question for?
Yes. The question is, a request is that when we talk to our state legislators about providing better protection for water quantity, I think we ought to also ask them to give better protection to water quality as well. What good is it to have an aquifer that's polluted and has to be cleaned up when this can be prevented by appropriate legislation?
It's funny that you bring up the TCEQ, because as a landowner who's tried very hard to protect his land, I find one of the biggest impediments to trying to protect land is TCEQ. They have allowed developers literally to run roughshod over surrounding landowners as far as what they can do with eminent domain, as far as running water lines, sewer lines, dumping material into surrounding properties. And I wonder from the panel if you think there's any hope that at some point we get an advocate for the landowner and an advocate for overall environmental quality, because I think TCEQ basically will tell you that they view their job as working with developers to make sure that they can provide the sewer systems, the water systems, the things like that. In fact, at a public hearing, they as much as said recently, said it's our job to facilitate and to issue permits. That's what we're here for. And do you think there's any chance at any point in the future that we'll ever have an advocate on TCEQ, which is a little bit more out to protect the landowner and the different lands around these projects that are impacted by it? I suspect you ladies may have had some issues with TCEQ. If not, I suspect you will one of these days. And perhaps you'd like to comment on that. And perhaps you as a planner would like to comment on things that we can do to improve TCEQ from a landowner's point of view.
You mean eminent domain fight number six?
That and others.
I hope not. No, we just watch our neighbors having trouble with TCEQ. And as you say, rubber stamping, and they don't come out and they don't look, and we have Heritage Ranchers drinking water that would be directly below the discharge spot for treated effluent. So I don't know. I just hope we can get some common sense.
You know, the fact of the matter is, and this is only my opinion, not the opinion of any other organization mentioned tonight, is that Texas is still run like the Wild Wild West. And, you know, whether it's TCEQ or other agencies, but there needs to be an absolute overhaul of the way we approach things at the state level. And if there's anything that would drive me into an elected position, it would be absolutely this issue right here. Because as I said earlier, you know, killing the goose that laid the golden egg is exactly what's happening in the Hill Country. And Texas is very much a strong landowner's rights state, and I respect that. But we cannot, in my opinion, put that above the integrity of preserving what is important from us from a natural resource perspective or even an aesthetic perspective.
Is it legally possible for the local counties to incentivize really smart growth? It does not impact aquifers, does provide better watershed management, or are they totally restricted to not get into any promotion of better quality of development?
Some counties have attempted that, and then they've kind of withdrawn from that a little bit. You can try and promote types of developments. Like, for example, you could try and promote clustered subdivisions, and the incentive you can provide is maybe fast-tracking in terms of the development review process. But really outside of that, there's very, very little in Texas that I've seen, at least, in terms of incentivizing the right kinds of quality development or smart growth development. It just really isn't done in Texas, and it's largely because of that lack of authority.
Yes, sir.
The gentleman that referred to TCEQ, it's unfortunate, and I'm not in any way defending them, because I think they are exactly like you say. They go with the people who are interested in development. But if I had my way, and I'm not saying this just because I'm running for office, okay, but the TCEQ board should be made up of people who have experience, not just businessmen, but rather they should also be made up with people from the farming community, the ranching community, and those who are just trying to get by. We should have a larger board, and it should represent a lot wider spectrum of our society.
We have one question back here. And I believe this will probably need to be our last question.
My question is this. Is there any consideration being given at a local, state, or federal level to a moratorium on development in the Hill Country? That is my question. And the reason I ask is this ice plant, which is cut down by landowners, developers, without any restraint, is the food for the monarch butterfly, which is currently migrating through the Hill Country, and it's one of many migratory species whose food sources are being completely erased by lack of regulation. So I ask, can there be a moratorium until everyone is educated as to the interconnected web of life that has no representation?
I'll speak to that. A group in Northwest Bexar County and Medina County and any other Hill Country county that cares to join us. We have organized the Hill Country Planning Association. We have already written a moratorium for development in our part of the county. And we've passed it out to the county commissioners and also to the city of San Antonio authorities. And we have, well, I guess we got a comment of recognition from the county commissioners, but nothing from anybody else. But needless to say, we do have on record our moratorium on development in Northwest Bexar County. And that is because we have been asking again and again for some kind of regional planning for our area.
I know the Groundwater Conservation District right here in Kendall County did put a memoriam on issuing groundwater development permits for some period of time until they had what they call a managed available groundwater number. So in other words, they wanted to get a handle on how much water they can appropriate before they continue to do so. But I believe that's ended them up with a lot of lawsuits. And again, these groundwater districts are pretty financially strapped as it is already. So, this is the only county I know of that's done such.
And I'll say too that cities and elected officials at city and county level, they're very afraid of lawsuits for whatever reason. And every moratorium that I've ever heard of at the city level in Texas has always been hit with some sort of a lawsuit or another. I know there have been a lot of cities in Central Texas that have issued moratoriums. Kyle, for example, in Hays County issued a moratorium when they realized they didn't really have enough water to support some of their developments. But I don't know too many counties that have put a moratorium on development because you have to have a very, very compelling reason, and they can't always find that justification that will hold up in court at the county level.
Let me inject here for an update. We're going to stop right here because this is the end of the Texas Public Radio recording. I want to make an announcement. On the back table, there's a sheet there for evaluation of this symposium. You can provide us with feedback, but there's a couple sections on there where you can provide suggestions for future topics for the Water Symposium that you would like to see addressed. The other thing I wanted to comment on is if you go to the Schreiner University website or go to your browser and type in Texas Water Symposium, it'll take you to the website. And on that website, we have all of last year's symposia that were broadcast by Texas Public Radio, and you can download those broadcasts to your computer and listen to those particular broadcasts if there were topics of interest to you from last year's symposium. So, you know, you could kind of catch up and see what we've covered so far and provide some input for, you know, what you'd like to see us to do in the future. And while I got this mic right now, let's take a break. If you have more questions, I think we're willing to stick around here for another 15 or 20 minutes and ask questions. I'm sure the panelists would like to interact with you after this. There's coffee and cookies left down there. But first, I really want to thank the panelists, our moderator, for a great job tonight. Thank you.